Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
And follow your star, brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on...
Susan Reed with us. She's the author of The Diversity Index, The Alarming Truth About Diversity in Corporate America and What Can Be Done About It. She's an award-winning investigative journalist and an author who's covered many aspects of the workplace over her 25-year career. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the American Perspective, and other publications. She contributes a column on international business for GlobalPost.com, a former producer for CBS News, reporting from 34 countries. She's been a guest speaker on C-SPAN, Harvard University, Boston University, and my goodness, this list goes on. Susan, hi. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, it's an interesting word, diversity. It takes on so many different faces. Let's get a basis and say diversity is defined as what, so we can move from there. What are we dealing with when we say that word?
Well, it's really taken from the 1978 Supreme Court case, the Bakke case, if you remember. He was a student applying to medical school, and the Supreme Court said that you could not just use race as a guiding factor in admitting students. You had to look to other forms of diversity. You had to look for talents, achievements, social background, economic background, and even geographic background. So that is really diversity. And then after that time, it sort of grew to include gender as well. So we're looking at
sure.
a whole different range of elements.
Now, when we deal with diversity in the workplace, what kind of diversity are we talking about? Are we talking about that basic concept of it's got to be mixed, or we are talking about diversity in the ability to handle the job? Is that diluted in any way when we look at this word diversity and how it's applied in the business world?
Oh, so are you asking where does ability fall within diversity?
Yeah, that we could say it that way, sure, yeah.
Well, that's, I think it's a critical component. At this stage, I don't think you would have many people saying that people are hired just because of their race or their gender. I think that you had that 50 years ago when affirmative action first began, and in fact, this is the 50th anniversary of affirmative action. The program was really quite controversial, but I did a study on the companies that had been involved in it from the very beginning, and they had more diverse leadership at the top than the companies that didn't participate or were not established at that time. So it really worked to integrate people into the workplace.
You know, this can be a very confusing issue if somebody doesn't have a handle on it. Let's go back with you and ask you, when was it that you took a look at this subject matter and decided that you should delve into it, because there were unanswered questions that led to some kind of a balance in the workplace?
Yes, well, you know, about 2000, I began reporting on employment discrimination suits for the New York Times. And these suits tend to be very acrimonious. The employers are pitted against the employees, and employers accuse their employees of being lazy or, you know, unqualified or unpromotable, and the employees accuse the employers of being racist or sexist. And I thought, well, really, how diverse is corporate America? And I just couldn't get my hands on the data that I needed to paint a panorama for the reader. And so that's when I decided to do my own study, and I looked at the Fortune 100 companies, and I looked at the demographic data of their executive officers. These are the people who are legally responsible for running the corporation.
When this really had to come to the fore would be, well, not 10, 15 years ago, but the sooner than that, because of the multinational business competition and the outsourcing that we've had because of the jobs that weren't filled, and then bringing people from other countries in to help us achieve the goals that, you know, that that we need to achieve. So when we talk about the diversity in the workplace, it's a lot different than it was 10, 15 years ago. And a lot of it is almost, it's implemented almost because it has to be to keep up.
Well, that very really surprised me, because I did not anticipate that I would find that 10% of the executive officers of the Fortune 100 were born overseas, born or raised outside of the U.S. And what's incredible to me is that the greatest competition is on the shoulders of white men, because 9% of white men were, of the white male executive officers, were born, say, in Europe, Norway, you know, France, Germany.
Sure.
And then there's another increased competition among Asians and Hispanics. More than half of the Asians and Hispanics who serve as executive officers in the Fortune 100 were born overseas. And although they may be a majority in their home country, say India or Colombia, when they come here, they're counted as a minority. It's entirely legal, and but it just shows that the diversity that exists today is not what we thought would exist 50 years ago.
Oh, sure, and I can see where it wouldn't be highly competitive for women. The women in the United States are treated completely different than women in Asia and some of the foreign countries. The rights, the ability to stand up and be what you want to be and do what you want to do. You can do that here. In other foreign countries, you can't do it. So I can see whereby women wouldn't have the problem with the competitive nature that the men would have with those coming in from the different countries.
It's very interesting, isn't it? I found that white women are really in a catbird seat right now. They have been widely successful. 90% of the top companies employ white female executive officers. They're thin at the top, you know, less than two per executive team. But they don't have this outside competition from abroad that white men and Asians and Hispanics have. Also, African-American men, they don't have that same competition from abroad either, yet. And now we'll wait until Africa becomes more developed.
Now, by the way, when we take a look at this, if we project, you know, 5-10 years in the future, based on all of your information, all of the studies that you've garnered and the information from the studies, is it going to become, I don't like to use the word worse, that's not what I'm talking about, is it going to become more diverse, more complex as we get more global? Because if you take a look at what's going on today and you look at the percentages of ethnicity and the different birth rates, you find the white birth rate is becoming less and less and less. I think it was less than 50% of all the babies born in the last few years, you know, were white babies. So the white population within, I'd say, 10 years or so is not going to be the majority in the country, and the definition of minority is going to have to turn completely around.
Yes, but at the same time, companies are becoming so global that, you know, the majority, I mean, right now the Asians are the majority. So that is going to impact it too. And I see a possibility that as the corporation becomes more multinational, we're going to have, you know, an increased array of multinational officers. You're right. I mean, white Americans could become the minority members.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
They could also, these companies could also move their headquarters outside of the U.S.
Oh, but
and that
by
is a,
the way,
that
that's
is an ongoing
yeah,
trend.
That's happening now. Yeah, that's happening now. And what I really see in this, if you can't, Susan, you can't solve a problem if you don't know what the problem is. Most people work on a problem they don't have as opposed to the one that they do have. They end up not getting anywhere. So where I think the power of your book is and your work is to lay the base of, look, this is what's going on now. Here's your facts. And project ahead, this is what could happen. You've got one or two choices here, to prepare for it or get stuck with it when it happens and not know where to go.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think that we have to, I mean, something has to be done and can be done on several different levels. But a major level is that we have to have a big conversation in this country about the kinds of jobs and the kinds of skills that we're going to need in the future here. Corporations have to speak up and start talking to the citizens in their communities and saying, look, you have to know how to do math. You have to know how to write. You have to, you know what a molecule is. I mean, we are in a technological world. We don't even know the products that we're going to be using 10 years from now. And frankly, we're turning out 7,000 engineers a year here in the U.S. China is turning out 30,000 a year.
Sure. No, absolutely. Look at the dropout rate in our high schools, not even talking about the ongoing and continuing education and the cost to do so for families. But you look at the high school dropout rate, Detroit, 50-55%, an average of 20-30% across the country. Well, if you've got that kind of a dropout rate, you don't have that competitive edge that you would have or you would have had years ago based on the technology. The ideology is changing, the culture is changing, and with that, it has the effect on business and what's going to go on in business in the next 10, 15 years. You know, I think you're absolutely 100% spot on. I couldn't argue it. I don't care what I did. But I think a real problem here is when they drop money into education, you can't drop it into brick and mortar. You can't drop it into classes that teach you how to socially be correct. It's got to be dropped into those classes that will teach these kids how to be able to compete and work in a world that they're going to be that'll be addressing them in the next 10, 15 years.
Yes, that's right. And I recommend that the corporations get involved with these schools like they did, only on a deeper level than they did during the first affirmative action program. They went out to the schools and they said to the students, look, we want you, but you have to learn how to do these things. You have to stay in school. You have to graduate. And there was a national educational campaign, a media campaign that said, stay in school. And then these vocational schools were started as well. But really, we need to get corporations involved earlier on. I mean, in K through 8 as well as K through 12. And there are some corporations that have really started doing that. They contribute directly into by buying new curriculum for the schools, and they contribute heavily to the education of the teachers. I mean, I spoke to a teacher who never learned how to teach science to students, never learned how to teach math. Well, you have to get in at that level if you want to make a difference.
No, and I think one thing to add to the mix here, we're starting to run out of time, but the one thing to add to the mix is what a corporation is today. You know, quote unquote, and I don't happen to believe this, corporations are evil, so keep them away from the kids, keep them away from the schools, they're going to control you and yada, 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 you know the story. Mm-hmm. So we have that we run up against also. We're in a very interesting time in our world here. And I say our world here, our world all over the globe. So we're what we thought was so isn't so anymore. What we thought was definable isn't definable anymore. And what we thought would be something that we could depend on and count on may not be so. So we're in a very interesting time in our world. And I also think information like this has to be brought up to be taken a look at, to be thrown into the mix. So, you know, the entire unilaterally, we can take a look at what we need to do and then move forward.
Well, for sure. And while companies are rethinking, you know, their sustainability in terms of the environment, they have to think about the sustainability of the communities where they operate. We can't have wholesale jobs leaving this country, and we can't have huge numbers of, you know, immigrants coming in to, you know, run the corporations. I'm not anti-immigrant, but we currently have 10 times the number that we should.
Yeah. No, by the way, absolutely, and I hear it from where you're coming from. We have a country here that if we're not very careful, we're not going to be in charge of what goes on. We're not going to be in charge of business. We're not going to be in charge of politics. We're not going to be in charge of anything. So we have to really take a look at how to define redefine the culture that we're in, get a hold of something that everybody can agree to, some kind of collaboration, and then move forward from there. But I really do believe at this stage of the game, it's going to take these pieces and parts, like you've got one piece of it, somebody else is going to have another piece, and then it all comes together.
Well, I certainly hope so.
I do. I'm on your side.
We've got to make this happen.
Susan, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at and buy the book.
I'm at thediversityindex.com, and that will have more information about the book. And also it's for sale at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.
Now, I hear you loud and clear. And by the way, thank you so much for being here. Great job, and we're behind you 3,000%.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed every minute of it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Comrie Palmer with us. She's an author, a public speaker, community spokesperson, and a former journalist for the Toronto Star. She's the CEO of Countess Productions, a production company she formed for radio, television, and journalism projects. She's also a past champion figure skater and an Olympic team member. Now, her book is Dying to Get There. At 6 years old, she was pronounced dead when her heart failed after surgery. And at 42, she died again from heart failure and was clinically dead for 23 minutes. Now, what happened to her during those 23 minutes? She remembers everything, every detail. Comrie, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, hello. How are you this evening?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. What an interesting experience. There are a lot of people who would just not be able to wrap their arms around this. Let's go back to the first time it happened to you. Did you have any memory whatsoever?
Well, I have very little memory of what happened while I was dead at the six-year-old time, because I just don't recall that. I remember everything from the second journey I took. The first time, however, the results of the death experience, that I remember completely.
No, by the way, the second time.
Yes.
What actually happened? Did you know you were dead?
Well, I guess I did. Yes, I did.
Okay. What actually happened?
Oh my, that's what the book is about. It goes into great detail, but it talks about how the soul energy leaves your body and where it goes and what it does and what it experiences, and it gives you the lessons of life, of where you have been and where you are now and how to take control of your life and direct it and where you're going from here. It was an amazing experience.
Now, by the way, we won't talk the book itself because obviously, you know, dying to get there, it's got it all. But let's talk about a few things. When it did happen to you, was there, were did you feel like you were in a physical form or was it a spiritual form? What did you experience? Well, what did you, go ahead.
That's a fantastic question, and I have never been asked that before, and it's the best question ever because the form you are in is a mental form.
Hmm.
It is the juices of the mind that is having this experience, rather than your body having the experience or your emotions
sure.
having the experience.
Because one of the things I've always thought, and I have to say thought because I haven't gone through it, that, you know, when your physical body dies, there's got to be something left, whatever that essence of you is that causes you to move forward. And I know from past experienced interviews that I've done 20 some odd years ago plus, that there, who was it? It was Kubler-Ross.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, I did an interview with her, and she was talking about that when someone dies, and they've done it a few times, if the body weight from when they were alive until after they died, it was like ounces different. So there's actually a difference in the form of the weight of the body. So whatever leaves is that energy, and that energy does have some physical weight.
Has weight to it, absolutely. That is correct.
Yeah.
And another thing, too, is when I came back to life after that 23 minutes, and I was remembering everything so clearly, as long as my mind held on to it, my body was weighed tons. But then as my mind let go of the past life experiences that I had experienced while I was on the death side of life, as I let go of those experiences, bit by bit, my body came back to its natural, normal weight.
Okay, now that essence that was you once the body went, is that the essence that we talk of that's spirit? You know, if you were to label it, was that spirit?
No, I would call it soul.
Okay, all right.
Life force, soul. Energy, soul. Because the reason I say that is because when we evolve past the human plane level, we go to the spirit plane level. And the spirit and the soul are really two different things, although we often interchange those two words. They really are two different things.
Okay, so there's a difference between the spirit and the soul.
Yes.
Now, which one would be the connection with all of us? Because there is something that connects you and I. There's no space between
us. That's the life force energy that is the soul.
Okay.
And I have referred to it as a superior energy entity, which is a humongous ball of pure white light, hot energy.
So the soul is the energy that keeps us all linked and connected. So then the spirit, is that our individuality?
Spirit, technically speaking, is not in us, it's with us.
Okay. All right, so the soul is the you.
Is in us. The soul is the life force energy that is in us. And it's the soul life force energy that leaves us when we die and we're left with a body that is organs and bones and skin.
No,
nothing activating it, right?
Yeah, that part of you that left and that came back,
right.
Can you recognize it now? Or if somebody dies, is there a way that they could recognize that within themselves to tap in to what's necessary to be able to survive in this world?
I'm not sure I understand the question. You're asking me, do you recognize your own soul?
No. Okay, let me do it this way. I'm thinking the question as you're talking. You died for the 23 minutes. Okay, so your soul left you, is that correct?
For 23 minutes, yes.
For 23 minutes, okay. Now, when it came back, when you came back alive, are you now able to recognize the soul that you didn't recognize before you died? That essence.
You mean, can I feel that in my body?
Yeah, can you recognize it? Do you know now it's there but that you didn't
Absolutely.
Know before? Absolutely. Okay,
my idea now is that I'm working in partnership rather than me, Comrie, running my life. It's Comrie and my soul that are running my life.
Okay, now let me take it to the second part of the question.
Okay.
Do I have to die to be able to recognize that within me that connects me to spirit?
No, you only have to listen to someone that can tell you how it works, how the function of the evolution of the soul works, and where you know the soul has been and where it is now and where it's going, then you can recognize it within yourself. I often have people look in the mirror and just look in their eyes in the mirror and say hello to their soul and get to know their soul and work together.
Okay, so when this happened to you, how did it change your life? What part of your life was expanded beyond the way it was before you died?
Well, it changed drastically. When I was 6 years old and died and came back, my body propelled ahead in age, and I all of a sudden, within a month's time, had the young body of a teenage girl and a monthly cycle of a young girl. And so I was just shot right ahead in age, and because of that, my left leg didn't grow. And so my two legs were two different lengths, and so that's why I started skating, to exercise my leg, and that's how I became a champion skater, and my legs are perfect and well-matched, and everything is great. Then at 42 years old, excuse me, I'm just getting over this cold that's going around up here. At 42 years old, I had the reverse happen. I went backwards in age and became younger looking and full of life and vitality, and I am 80 years old. I don't sound like an 80-year-old, I'm told, and I don't move like an 80-year-old. I don't act like an 80-year-old. I don't even look like an 80-year-old. I've got long blonde hair. I still have the figure skater's body. But other than the physical difference, in the second time around, there was a huge mental difference. Prior to the 23 minutes, my 15-minute claim to fame was I was a champion skater. Great, I was, and I was a good skater. I am a good skater, and that was wonderful. But 23 minutes later, I was a satellite transmission specialist, and the Canadian government have sent me to developing countries to build telecommunications buildings. I went to Peru to build a building on the University of a Superior Technology University campus, and I opened my mouth to hire a construction crew, and poof, I spoke Spanish. Well, I never studied Spanish, and I never studied satellite transmission, and I never studied a lot of things that I ended up doing that were somehow zapped into my mind in that 23 minutes of time.
But zapped into your mind. There's that. We talked about the spirit. That's that connecting force that throughout the universe. Now, if you have a connecting force, if I learn Spanish and you're connected with me, can you tap into what I have for you to use?
I call it more the cosmic mind, because there's a cosmic mind that is the major internet of all. It's the place where all information is held. And the cosmic mind is what zapped into my body as my soul passed through.
You know, I can just see after this interview, women going down to the local morgue and saying, "I'm ready, I want the body."
Well, that has been an expression of mine. If we could all just die once or twice through life, you know, it would be great. I came back younger and smarter. I mean, what's not to like about that? But, you have to look at the good side of everything. I also, there's a negative side. My marriage ended, so my husband couldn't understand where I was coming from after the experience, and so that was sad. But, you know, these things happen.
Of course they do. And as a matter of fact, I really believe in my heart of hearts, everything that happens is meant to be. And he probably ended up with a life that he could deal with. You know, obviously,
correct,
you're not the kind of person that a lot of people can deal with, because you've got to be scary to some people, because it's beyond the realm of what they believe is possible. And if you go beyond their limits, their line in the sand, so to speak, you're very scary.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I experience that on a regular basis. And when the person asks me, "Oh, gee, what do you do to stay so young-looking and whatever," I kind of look at them and I sort of think about it first. Do I give them the real answer, or I just say, you know, lots of party time or whatever, something silly? And
no, you hand them
there's
the
truth
book.
To that, you know?
Yeah, oh, no, absolutely. Because, and it doesn't mean that anybody's weak. It just means that they haven't experienced it, and it's just like thinking what's beyond. Space has to stop, doesn't it? But how can it stop? How can you have something that doesn't end? None of us on this planet with our linear minds can fathom that.
Right,
so it scares people.
Right. And then understandably so, you know. And one of the other blessings, I mean, all of this intellect that was sapped into my mind has been marvelous. My journalism career, I write for 5 newspapers around the world still, and I mean, that I didn't know how to do that, and Zap, I just knew how to do that. But, you know, one of the major things, I learned astronomy, and from astronomy I learned astrology. And from astrology, I learned the paranormal. And all of that was given to me in that time period because my mind is more of a scientific mind than an esoteric mind. I mean, you know, the ghost and goblin things and everything, oh, that's all very interesting, but I want to know why, you know, that expression of you want to know why. But one of the things that I did learn, how to do, or that was given to me, the knowledge that was given to me, was to be able to see auras, you know, that energy field that emanates from around people.
Absolutely.
All live things have this aura energy. Well, that has been an amazing asset to me, particularly when I'm doing my speaking engagements, because as long as there is a yellow glow over the tops of the heads of the people I'm speaking to, it means that they can comprehend what I'm saying. But once that yellow glow goes, it means that their brain is full. They can't handle anymore. And you know then when to stop your lecture or your talk. And it's a great asset. You don't have to wait till they fall asleep and start snoring and falling in the aisles, you know.
I want to make one comment about astrology. I say, thank goodness for one thing.
What's
it's
that?
It's over today.
Yeah, pardon me?
I said, it's over today.
Oh, it's over today.
Yeah.
Well, that's the
Mercury
pop astrology.
Did you hear me?
No, I can't.
Oh, is it Mercury in retrograde? Last
day.
Oh,
well, that's over today, yes.
That's
the retrograde is over.
Thank goodness for that.
Thank goodness for that is true, because I'm a Virgo. Are you a Virgo?
No, I'm a triple Scorp. I'm a triple Scorp.
A Scorpio?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's okay. They're a good sign. They're all good signs. They all have their good sign to them. But the Mercury retrograde certainly fouls up radio announcers, that's for sure.
Tell me, communication? don't have a computer or a fax machine, you're in trouble.
No, that's right.
We're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website where we can find you at, buy the book, and get more information?
Absolutely. Would you like me to give it to you?
Please.
Okay, it's www.comriepalmer.com. And my name is C-O-M, like in mother, R-I-E-P-A-L-M-E-R.com.
Comrie, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it. You've got a great story.
Well, thank you so much for having me on air.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy, 'cause I wanna be. Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
Whatever you've done, it's all over.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. Tamara Ryder with us. She's the author of Where's the Watch and Other Tales, a memoir from Seinfeld's Uncle Leo. The great character, actor Len Lesser, was best known for his role as the eccentric Uncle Leo in the 90s classic sitcom with Seinfeld. But his acting career was much more than that. Spanning six decades now, he appeared in films such as Kelly's Heroes, Birdman of Alcatraz, How to Stuff a Wild Bikini, Papillon and the Outlaw Josie Wales, and the list goes on. He worked with Dustin Hoffman, Steve McQueen, Clint Eastwood, Barbara Streisand, Mel Brooks, Frank Sinatra, among so many others. And Tama was hired by Lesser to write his memoir. And let's talk about Lesser. Hey, Tama, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much for being here. What a project that must have been.
It really was. You know, I was just listening to your guest before talk about auras, and Len certainly had one. He was just such a charismatic man, as you saw on Seinfeld and in all of his films. So it was just, it was wonderful getting to know him and working with him every day on this.
But he was a different kind of a guy. I mean, because obviously he had to be diverse enough to do all the things that he did do. And obviously you got in here, he was, you know, quite a ladies' man, quote unquote. And more important, it changed his life. He was even recognized at the Wailing Wall in Israel, somebody yelling out, "Uncle Leo, where's the watch?" So this man really made a dent, didn't he?
He really did. He really did. You know, he was amazed by it because by the time he was on Seinfeld, he actually was 68 years old. You know, he had a huge body of work, as you mentioned, and had worked with, you know, all these incredible people. And so Seinfeld was just, it was another gig for him. And while he was on Seinfeld, he appeared in really only a handful of episodes. In between, he was doing a lot of stage work. He was going on other auditions for more films. He was doing a lot of volunteer work, the usual Len stuff. And he was just surprised that, just as you mentioned, he was in Israel. He'd be anywhere, and people would come up and yell, you know, "Where's the watch?" or "Hello, Uncle Leo," one of his classic lines, and he thought it was hysterical because, as I said, for him it was another gig, and he didn't realize just what an impact he had had on the public, but he loved it.
You know, by the way, I like the idea of when I say that he got you to do this, and the reason for that is this, that where I totally resonate to this. I don't like to know much about a guest coming on the show. As a matter of fact, it's probably 3 seconds before the guest comes on that I get the bio or whatever it is in front of me, and that way it can free flow. Now, that said, what I love about what you've done, you're a Harvard-educated writer, you grew up without a TV, and, you know, you wrote and produced the documentaries and things, but the key is you didn't have a pre-planned thought of what it was going to be about, what it was like. You weren't a television addict. So when you got it fresh, and it just had to come out.
Absolutely, no, you're right, and that's what Len liked about it too. Because actually, when we met, we met through another writer. I was working on a novel at the time, and another writer friend of mine was not able to do the project, and he passed my name along to Len. And Len interviewed me, and we were speaking, and of course it came out that I had grown up without a television. And I also told Len at that meeting that I had only watched Seinfeld one time. I said I had only watched it once, that I didn't have a television. I wasn't familiar really even with Seinfeld, and I certainly wasn't familiar with his films and his stage work. So he liked that a lot. He thought that that was really fun because obviously most people, as we know today, are familiar certainly with Seinfeld, but even his film work. And so he liked that. And when we started working together, it was fresh. And he enjoyed, I think, really telling me a lot of his life and telling it to me. You know, it was the first time, you know, for him telling his story. But also it was so amazing to me because I was never exposed to the things he was talking about and certainly not to someone who had lived the life that he had.
No, absolutely. No question about it. But when, once you sat down with him, once he began to talk to you and the facades, the masks kind of melted away, drifted away, what did you see? What experience did you walk away with that will stay with you?
I think that the experience that has really resonated with me is Len's perseverance and the fact that he, in the end, Seinfeld was just, as I mentioned before, another gig for him. He did this for 65 years. He did this his whole life.
Sure.
Right before he passed away, he was just starting a new TV show. He had completed a play in Canada. He was 88 years old, and this was just something that he continued doing. And I think that what really resonated with me was the fact that he had pursued this for his entire life. And in between, he didn't earn a lot of money. He was doing things. He was a dishwasher for a while. He was a factory worker for a while. And early on in life, actually, Len graduated from college when he was 19. He had a double major in economics and government. He then decided to enlist in the military. He was in the Army. He enlisted right after Pearl Harbor, and he served the country for a number of years and then came back and said, you know what, I'm really interested in acting. And he started pursuing acting and really studying it. He went to the New School. He went to graduate school at Bennington. And he was doing all of this, theater work, and he did things with the New York City Opera, and still not really making a lot of money or getting the roles. He was actually asked at one point by Bennington College to be a professor there, and he turned that down because he said, no, you know, my dream is to act. And so he continued doing that, and then, actually, before he was even on Seinfeld for a period in the 80s, he battled cancer a number of times. He actually battled it 3 times. And so as I was writing this and kind of piecing together a story and getting to know Len, I was just amazed by the fact that he had such determination and persevered and was able to be content. He ultimately was just such a happy person because he felt by the end of his life that he had done everything he wanted to do. And he hadn't earned a lot of money, but that didn't matter to him.
Tamla, was the character and all the different characters that he played, et cetera. Now, not romantically, but did you fall in love with this guy? And when I say fall in love with him, there had to be that essence, that something, that spark within him that caused him to do and be everything that he ever did in the movies and caused people to connect with him.
Yes, I absolutely. I think that once you knew Len, and even people say now in reading Len's story, that you couldn't help but fall in love with him. I did a launch party here in New York with Jerry Stiller, and Jerry Stiller was just saying, you know, I love Len. I loved him, and I you know, he's just such a special guy. And the same with Ed Asner, who is a longtime friend of Len's, who wrote the foreword for this book. And as you can imagine, Jerry Stiller and Ed Asner, they've met everyone. They've known everyone. They've done a lot of things. And yet Len was very unique. And I think that, you know, I certainly connected with the fact that he was, as I mentioned before, doing all of these different things. And he was ultimately just a normal working guy. And again, that was what was interesting about him, is that he was in this atmosphere and working in Hollywood, but at the same time he was just a normal guy who served our country, who went to school for a while. People could connect with that, and I think that's what people ultimately connect with when they watch him on screen. I was just watching Kelly's Heroes again the other night, where he's on screen with Eastwood and Sutherland and Don Rickles and Telly Savalas, all of whom he got to know and hung out with on set. And Eastwood went on to hire Len for the Outlaw Josie Wales, and they had a great rapport. But Len was a popular guy on that set, I know, and he had some great stories about doing that. And he was also, as you mentioned, a ladies' man. I think that women also just found something about him very charming and very charismatic.
You know, he came from a very interesting time in Hollywood. I grew up in the days when the movies, if there was a bedroom scene, you know, the law said that there was 1 foot on the floor, Doris Day, Rock Hudson, and the list goes on. And it was, you know, in the old days when at the end of the movie, the cowboy didn't kiss the girl, he kissed the horse. That's what he was brought up with. And that's that charisma with inside of him. He grew up and he was in Hollywood in a very innocent time in Hollywood. And that extended on. And I imagine that would be, if I would have met him, that would have been the thing that I would have seen and recognized within him. There was that it had to be, if you look at his picture, the one where he's got his hand up on his cheek and he's smiling, there's a very soft look about the man, but there's also a very understanding look about the man. The man knew you when you talked to him.
Yes. Yes, definitely. I would 100% agree with that assessment. I think that that's exactly how Len came across. And he was also just very, very understated as well. I think that really resonated with people too.
Now, by the way, when you started to do the work, when you actually started to listen to him, and this is going to be an interesting answer. When somebody decides to put something to pen, fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be, there comes that part in the writing that you take a look at it, whatever the subject matter is, and there's that cathartic moment where there's that aha, that there's something that you recognized about yourself or learned that you didn't know before. Where was that in all of this?
What I learned about myself and in doing this process, yeah. I would say that I guess that ultimately just going back to what I told you before, I think that I was just amazed by Len's determination. I think ultimately, in terms of wanting to then share his story, that became very important to me, particularly after he passed away in February. I think that I felt in going through my notes and in finalizing the book, I felt that it was very important that people read about Len, that they could hear his voice. And I think that I felt that he had a great message, and I felt that that was very important to get out.
Now, by the way, let me say that. Let me ask that question in just a little bit of a different way. Where did you see yourself in him and he in his story?
Where did I see myself?
You had to recognize something to be able to really put this to pen.
I guess that probably I identified with the fact that he had pursued something that he really wanted to do. I think that as a writer, I connected with that. As someone, as you mentioned before too, who did documentaries, I worked in journalism. It's something where you have to want to really do it, and I think that was something that that I connected with.
Yeah, that strength of commitment to yourself or the projects or whatever it is that you're going to do. There's so many people that get lost today. What I'm hearing also in this, that a very subtle underlying message is that it's okay to believe in yourself, because if you do, you can move through just about every challenge that there possibly is, and what might be important to someone else, quote unquote, like money, doesn't have to be important to you. You create your own values, and from those values, you move forward.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think another thing too, in regards to Len, something that's kind of interesting is that Len bought a house in 1962. It was in Burbank, California, and it was just this little house, and he finally was able to afford to buy a house after being in Hollywood for a number of years, and he never left that house. It's a little cottage, and at one point he was able to move on, and he chose not to. He decided not to sell it, and he wanted to remain in the same house. He lived a very simple lifestyle, and all of his money and any extra money he had, he gave to charity. He was very involved. He actually adopted both of his children. He was very involved in adoption issues around Los Angeles, and I think that those were things that were important to him.
Now, by the way, when we find somebody that does this, see, what you've done actually is you've created his legacy. Now, he contracted you to do so, But then this is one of the things, even with the movies, when somebody picks up the book and they get the individual themselves, it comes alive. They recognize themselves, or it gives them the impetus to move forward when they hit that challenge that causes them to want to quit along the way. So in essence, what the book is really about, it's a legacy. 100 years from now, somebody can pick up the book and get the same message out of it, no matter what the culture is like, what society is like, and what the world is like.
I hope so. I really hope so, and I think that was Len's intention as well.
Now, by the way, in 150 years or so from now, when I'm doing the same thing here on the air, I'll make sure it happens.
Okay. I appreciate it. I know Len would too.
Tamara, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you, find the book, find out the projects
you're doing? Yes, absolutely. I do. It is tamarider.com. It's TAMARYDER.com. You could also find me on Facebook at author Tamara Ryder or on Twitter. And
wonderful.
The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and hopefully at your local bookstores.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Good night.
Good night.
That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a lover's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Claudia Nelson up next.
Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old, because I won't.
Claudia Nelson is the author of Rising from the Ashes. When acclaimed personal empowerment specialist Claudia Nelson's mother and sister were murdered in 1990 in a robbery, she began a 501(c) nonprofit organization called International Association for Families to find ways to create safer communities for families. This effort crossed international borders and saved the lives of many, many children. Claudia and her family filmed a segment for CBS's 48 Hours, Live to Tell, recounting the experience after her mom and her sister were murdered, as portrayed in Murder, Death, and Rebirth. The segment aired on December 10th, 2011. Let's say, Claudia, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I might mention that actually played Saturday night, and if anyone wants a replay, they can go to the CBS website and look for the Live to Tell 3 days before Christmas and replay it. Had very, very good reviews on it. People said it was the most powerful show they'd ever seen. So,
well, Yeah, because people can get it on demand with the cable network too.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, you want to say December 10th, 2011. That's just a couple of days ago.
It was just Saturday night.
Now, by the way, you lost your life savings in an international Ponzi scheme. You spent 8 years pursuing the con men to get them off the streets to prevent any new victims. Did it work? Did you get them?
I did.
Good for you. Now, by the way, and I'm so sorry to hear what happened to your mom and your sister, but what a legacy that they left. The people that whose lives get saved, their I'm going to say fortunes, and if a family's got enough money to live on and to make it through the world today, that in and of itself is a fortune. So their giving up of their lives was paid forward to many, many people and in time to come, too.
Well, that's one way I resolved those. I decided that I was going to recover. I was not going to continue to be a victim of this. And I thought, I have a choice whether I stay a victim of this or whether I become victorious over it. And because I made that choice, I set three goals. One was to get them in prison so they couldn't hurt other people. The second was to help victims, and that's why I wrote the book that I did. And the third was to get the information out to the people to prevent more victims or help them recover if they have been victimized. So I'm one that very much believes that you should take a negative and turn it into a positive. And if you do that, there's always a blessing on the other side of tragedy.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. And the tragedies are not easy to go through. And it's getting through that challenge and getting just a little bit of a different mindset. And it does not mean you won't miss those loved ones for the rest of your life. But there's that transforming of the energy that went behind it. When we look at frauds today, you know, obviously there's the one that you get constantly in the email, and that's the one from Nigeria that you've got, you know, the $350 million that, you know, you're the beneficiary and they're going to send it to your bank account, so give us the numbers. You know, and, you know, it's so personal. It's, you know, dear sir or madam. The problem, I think, with that, and as ridiculous as it is, there are still a tremendous amount of people who do that, allow them to have the bank accounts, because if they didn't do that, they wouldn't be continuing with this stuff. And some of it's ridiculous, and some of it, the one that I saw that most people would have to be careful with, I got an email. Twice this has happened in the last couple of years. I got an email from somebody who said they were in England, and they somebody stole their wallet and their credit cards, and they need to get back home, and they, you know, can I send them a couple $1,000 or whatever the case may be, and we can do a bank transfer. You know, and these are people that I know, and it wasn't them.
No, I know. I received that one also.
Yeah.
It's really almost unbelievable that one in 18 Americans was defrauded in 2009 in America. And so you say, how can people be smart enough to make millions of dollars and be dumb enough to give it away to a con man, which is what happened in this Ponzi scheme? And what I discovered in my research and working with victims is that it has nothing to do with smart or dumb, and it has everything to do with vulnerability. And there are four kinds of people who are vulnerable to being conned and abused in other ways, and I call them the PAN people. It's an acronym for the protected, the addicted, the needy, and the naive. And probably I think the first three are pretty self-explanatory, but what about the naive ones? They are the ones that get caught in the Ponzi schemes because they are, well, the others do too, but this is one that's pretty insidious because people don't recognize that they are vulnerable and that they don't have enough self-esteem on their own to think they're enough without everything that money can buy. And so to make themselves feel more, they will get caught in that when they already have a lot. But they're afraid they'll lose it, and it just keeps them fear-based. And I think the two basic fears we have, one is that we're not enough, and the other is that we won't have enough, or if we have it, that we'll lose it. So what I teach people is if they're not going to be vulnerable to any kind of a scheme, they have to get to the place where they move out of that fear thought system to another thought system, because we do have two thought systems. And Einstein said it best. He said, you can't solve your problems at the same level of thinking you were at when you created them. And basically, he's telling us we have two thought systems, one where we create our problems, one where we solve them. And most people don't know that. And so they don't know how to get from one to the other, so they keep trying to solve them where they can't be solved. So what my books do is show people how to get from one to the other, from that place of feeling always disempowered to the place where they feel empowered, and they know if they lose something, they can create it again, which is what I have done with this Ponzi scheme, where other people were committing suicide, they lost their families, they lost everything. So it's a choice. It's a choice as to how we respond to it. And after making a choice, we have to focus then on the solution and not on the problem. And most people just perseverate on the problem. And that
the people who create the Ponzi schemes and these other, the ones from Nigeria or wherever they come from, they're smart. These are not dumb people. They know exactly what to say to trigger that emotional want that's going to cause somebody to buy something or to move forward with whatever it is that they're presented. We live in a world that, we live in a rewards-based culture. You're a child, your mom says to you, clean up your room, we'll take you to the show, do this, we'll give you candy. Well, we've learned that as adults. You want somebody to do something, you make it attractive enough for what you're going to give them that they're going to move forward and do it. And these people know exactly how to trigger those emotions within you to cause you to move forward, give up your bank account, credit card number, whatever the case may be. And it's horrible, but they are out there. We have to be careful.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, I have a chapter in the book on the language of good and evil and how they do use language to suck us in to their Ponzi schemes. And it's very much like the Satanists use to suck people into their covens.
Yeah, so yeah, no question about it. So they know exactly what they're doing. Process. Step
they do.
By step,
and, often thought, my gosh, if they would use these talents in a legitimate way, they could be really quite wealthy. Why do they have to use their talents that way? They're very intuitive. They know exactly how to get into your mind.
I've always thought that, a good thief is brilliant. And what would happen if those people just changed the way that they use that brilliance? It's the same thing that you're saying. It's true. You got to be really smart to get away with some of the things that you get away with. But inevitably, if you do it long enough and don't know when to quit, you're going to be in trouble. Bernie Madoff, and there's a few people like that they were doing fine until they got to that point where they couldn't hide it anymore. And he didn't know when to quit. So, bye-bye, Bernie, and he's in jail.
Well, when you get in a Ponzi scheme, you really can't quit because the Ponzi artist is pretty much sucked into that too. And anytime you quit, you are exposed, and so they keep them going as long as they can. And to keep a Ponzi scheme going, you have to continue to bring new people in. And once in my Ponzi scheme, where Dennis Cope was my personal Ponzi artist,
yeah.
We got suspicious of him, and we started sending the word out to the group, and then they stopped bringing people in, and it started to collapse, and that's when it all fell apart for him.
Yeah, well, when you take a look at the Ponzi schemes, when there's that point of, look at the housing problem that just occurred. If you think about what happened, the banks, they packaged up 8 or 10 different loans that they had, and they sold them off to someone. And they sold them off discounted. And those people packaged those 10 with another 10 and another 10, and they sold those off to someone who packaged that package up, continuously got to a point where, this multi-billion dollar package was literally only worth, maybe $10, $15 million.
Yeah. Well, it's really sad, and I think you said the key. You said if you will think about it, most of the time we don't think. We just react. And we react according to the way we have been programmed with other people's tapes. And when my life fell apart after the murders and my marriage, a lot of things fell apart, and I had to say, something's wrong here. I'd always been taught that if you do everything right, that your life will turn out right. Well, I had tried so hard to do everything right, but my life didn't turn out all right. And I said, there's something wrong with this. There's something wrong with my thoughts, because your thoughts create your actions create results, and your results in it. Let's see. Thinking creates your feelings create your actions, and your actions create your results. So I had to say, okay, if that's true, then something's wrong with my thinking. Well, where did I get my thinking? Well, I guess I got it from my parents, from my church, from my schools. Well, is that really working for me, and should I keep it? And most people don't stop to even think about that. They just react, and they're just they're living carrying case for somebody else's tapes, as I was. And to really heal myself, I had to go through and reprogram myself.
Dude, what it all boils down to is if I said this to you, guess what you're going to get from what I can do for you. And if you're vulnerable at that moment, you're mine.
I don't hear anything.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Did you hear what I said?
If you're vulnerable at that moment, that's the last thing I heard.
Oh, okay. I was waiting for you to respond. That's okay. But when you come right down to it, is, you know, what when somebody imagines they're going to get these vast amounts of something for their actions or their money or their participation, for most people, they're in, because it's almost greedy. And that's what they work on. You're greedy.
And that's one of the PAN people, the protected, the addicted, the needy, and the naive. And we are all really have more of addiction to money than we think that we do.
Okay, now we were talking about the difference of a mindset, just basically shifting the way that you think. What are one of the steps to do so for the average person?
Well, the first step, then, as I had mentioned, it's actually to realize that you have a choice. Most people just react, don't realize they have a choice. You need to ask yourself, am I going to remain a victim of this, or am I going to become victorious over it? The second step is then to grieve, but not to blame. If you've lost something, there's going to be grief, but don't get stuck in it. You need to grieve it. It may not come all at once, but you need to grieve it, or it's going to come back to bite you in the fanny. But don't blame, because it's not a matter of blame being good or bad. It's a matter of that blame doesn't work. It saps your energy, and you're going to need your energy to move forward. And so that is the third step. Do not focus on the problem. Focus on the solution. There's nothing you can do about the past. It's like, that's the image of the rising from ashes. The phoenix throws himself in this funeral pyre, burns to ashes, and then rises again. And that's what happens to our lives. We don't all of a sudden say, I need a new life. I'm going to throw myself in the funeral pyre. But life happens, and old things do die, and they burn to ashes. And you can't go back and put the ashes back together again. You need to let them go and rise to a better life, because there always is a better one, because you can create it with the way you think.
You know, when it comes down to it, you talked about blame. So let's say you and I get into something and it's your fault. Okay, I blame you. Okay, so what? I blame you, but do I feel any better because I blamed you? No, I've still got the same old problem. You're right. You work on the solutions, not the problem. Blame doesn't get you anywhere. Okay, now we know it's your fault. So what? What do I do now?
Does it matter, really? It's over and done with. Don't focus on it.
No question about it. And I really believe, when it comes down to it, is if you're aware of it and can anticipate the possibility of getting ripped off ahead of time, I think things come out completely different. I had an experience. There's a certain service that I have, and I charge X amount of dollars for. And I was talking to somebody. They liked the service. And I said, all right, it's X amount of dollars. And instead of doing it the normal way, they said to me, oh, can we just transfer money to your account? And I went, click, 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 ding, ding, ding. Okay. All the bells went up, and I said, I don't know how to do that. And they said, okay. And I never heard from them again. I tried calling them in a week. Nobody ever answered the phone again. So it's just understanding it and knowing it. And you don't get it.
Well, and that's where the media is so important. And I applaud you for having me on your show, because that's what I like to do, is help warn people and help prepare them not to get involved in this, and to recover, how to recover if they can. And so I do have a special report that tells more about the PAN people, the kind of people that are vulnerable, what to do if you have been conned, some of the characteristics of a con man, some of the psychological symptoms. So if any of your listeners would like that, if they would just go to ClaudiaNelson.com. And there's a special report on my website, and they can download that.
Wonderful. Now, Claudia, we're starting to run out of time. Can we also get the book on the website?
You bet. You certainly can.
Wonderful. Okay, so the website is www.ClaudiaNelson.com. Claudia Nelson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I'll go my way by myself. This is the end of romance. I'm gonna go my way by myself. Love is only a dance. I'll try to apply myself. Teach my heart how to sing. Yeah, you can bet I'll go my way by myself. Like a bird on the wing, I'll face the unknown. I'll build a world all my own. Then nobody knows better than I myself. I'm by myself alone. When you're alone, who cares for starlit skies? When you're alone, magic moonlight dies at break of dawn.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Julia Valentine with us, the author of Joy Compass, How to Make Your Retirement the Treasure of Your Life. She's the founder and CEO of Joy Compass. After Julia Valentine's grandparents went through years of debilitating illness and emotional meltdown before their death, she began to think about the process of growing older and how people could live better lives, if they know exactly what to do before it happens. Julia, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. And, you know, it's really strange that they've actually also managed to invest in a Ponzi scheme.
Oh, my goodness.
I was listening to you earlier, and I thought, how ironic.
Yeah, we never know how life turns out. I was going to do a lot more on your bio, but I had a black cat that just jumped in my lap, and she's pushing the microphone away, and she got between me and your bio.
How ironic again. So what shall we talk about then?
Okay. Now, by the way, not the black cat, but she's cute, but right now she's the best. Now, when you take a look at that, let's go back to when your grandparents died and you got the vision. And realistically, when you think about it, most people don't know what to do when retirement comes. We live in a world now that is so confusing and realistically so unsettled that we really need somebody to hold us by the hand and go step by step through the process.
And more importantly, there is more of a demand for understanding our values much, much better. And I think you talked about that earlier today as well, right? Understanding yourself, figuring out what exactly do you want from life. And that is becoming more and more important as people spend 20, 30 years in retirement or semi-retirement.
Oh, absolutely. Julia, and instead of, let's say, establishing our values, isn't it defining what our values are? I wonder how many people you've worked with, if you sit down with them and you say, what are your values? And for the most part, I would guess 90-some-odd% probably don't even know. And that's why they need somebody like you to say, okay, here's an option, here's an option, here's a choice. And then all of a sudden, a value begins to become stimulated.
I think some people do know what they want at all times, and others need to be asked questions. So to draw this out, my book steps you through the process of asking you what's important. You know, is it peace of mind? Is it freedom? Is it this or that? Because we all have values are universal and needs are universal, but the expression of them is unique, and that's what we need to understand to live a satisfying life, a joyful life.
Oh, no question about it. Now, you've got a degree in finance and economics from New York University. Now, the question is this, that if I were to create a retirement package 10 years ago, and I do one now, and if I did one 5 years from now, do you think they'd be three completely different packages?
Well, what you would have at all times is a plan, right? So what do I mean by plan? A lot of people say, I'm not a planner, just don't even talk to me about that. And then the question I ask them is, are you married? Yes, I am. Have you planned your wedding? Oh, of course, I planned three or four of them. Have you planned your vacation? Yes, of course, I have. So what happens when you have a financial plan is that you lay the foundation in place and you know that you need to think ahead. And then you adjust what you're doing within that plan. In other words, nothing is set in stone, right? You adjust depending on how old you are. You adjust depending on your financial situation, depending on what the market is doing. But overseeing exactly what's going on and finding the best options at different times, that oversight that we need over our financial situation.
And most importantly, and I know you addressed this, how vision is so vital. If I don't have a vision, if I don't know what it's going to look like, I'm never going to reach it.
You're never going to reach it, first of all, because if you don't know where you're going, it's like Alice in Wonderland, right? If you don't know where you're going, then, well, it doesn't matter which way you turn. But also, the reason that we want to plan vacations and weddings is because those are joyful events and there is motivation in that. Something needs to pull us, right? So either fear is going to, it's the carrot or the stick. So either the fear is going to move you to do certain things to avoid mistakes, and that's certainly been the case in my situation. I saw a lot of mistakes having been made, and I don't want to repeat them in my life. But also, there needs to be some enjoyment in looking forward to doing something wonderful and proactive for yourself.
Oh, no question about it. Mm-hmm. And it's that stimulation to know that there's something there. There was a movie, and I think it exemplifies everything you're talking about. Jack Nicholson was in it. Do you remember the movie About Schmidt? Did you see the movie?
I haven't seen it, but so many of my friends actually talked about it. He was psychoanalyst, right, or a psychotherapist.
Well, you see, what the movie was about is everything you're talking about. What he did was he was an executive. He was a manager in a large company. Well, he retired. And then when he got out there, his identity was left at the company. He got out there, and all of a sudden, there was nothing in the world there for him. There was no incentive. He didn't even know who he was anymore. And I really believe with that vision and that impetus to move forward as you're retiring, you get to take your identity with you. It switches from what you were to what you are now, and it becomes much more personal. That's what the movie was about. It was about somebody retiring without a plan and getting totally lost.
And probably retiring, then it's a completely different movie than what I was thinking about. But I should probably watch it and use it as an example.
Absolutely.
It's called the halo effect. When people are responding to your status and your position rather than you personally. And I have spoken to so many people who were so completely disappointed when they would go back to the companies where they worked. And they said, people see me on the elevator now and they don't even say hello.
Yeah.
And it's difficult for them to believe that the positive, that feeling of appreciation was actually aimed at their position.
Sure. And by the way, it lies in something you talk about is designing your destination. If you don't have a design, if you don't have a picture of it, if you don't know where you're going, guess what? You end up nowhere.
You end up nowhere. And also, psychologically, there is such a huge difference between how do you view the second half of your life. Because here's the tricky part about it. We form our opinions about getting older at a young age. And these opinions, you know, as you watch your parents, how your parents react, etc., a lot of times they're not even conscious. So I spoke to a friend and she said, when my mom turned 30, she locked herself in the bathroom and she cried the entire day. So imagine this is someone's unconscious expectation of how tragic it is to turn 30. Well, imagine you turn 60 and 70 and 80. What do you think about that, right? So Yale University researchers have done some studies, and what they realized is that if you view second half of your life in terms of becoming wiser, you'll live longer, 7.5 years longer. And the impact of that is actually stronger than quitting smoking or, you know, doing a regular exercise routine or some of the things that only will prolong your life for a year to 4 years. So
no question about it. It's a mindset. I mean, that's exactly what you're talking about. It is a mindset, and how you think you are is exactly how you're going to be. And if somebody doesn't believe that out there, if you're miserable out there, if you just don't like life the way it is, guess who created it? So if you could create it, you could uncreate and recreate. That's really what you're talking about. You got this straight.
Absolutely, and also doing it exactly where you are. No matter what age you are, no matter what your financial situation is, no matter what your personal situation is, looking at it as you stand today. If you didn't plan a year ago or 2 weeks ago, I don't care. Make that your New Year resolution. And as you were talking about the mindset and motivation and softer issues, let me add something else to that, knowledge. People who plan create twice the wealth of people who don't. And who are these planners? Well, these are the people who are financially literate. You see, they took the time either by copying their parents or grandparents or by taking the time to learn about it. They actually take the time to find out about financial education, financial tools, interesting resources that are out there. Because when I ask people, well, have you heard about this? Have you heard about that? There are all these things happening. Do you know about them? Have you attended them? There are regional events like Ideal Living Resorts and Retirement Expos, and they feature hundreds of properties where you could go and enjoy a lower cost of living and better weather. So there are options, but you need to take the time to find out about them.
Yeah, no, and also important, let's add something to the mix here. Knowledge is wonderful, but the true power is in the application of the knowledge. You have to have the knowledge to know it's there, but you also have to have somebody, for the most part, holding your hand to show you how to do it. That is the key. Just because we're human beings and we're adults and we do what we do doesn't mean that we know everything. My goodness, I wish I could say I knew everything. I don't. And there are areas that when I become the student very quickly, and you learn and you do things. See, I have the magic. I have something called a Rolodex, and if I don't know something, I know somebody who does know, and that's really.
And you invite them on your show. It's like, what do I need to know this week, and who do I call?
Absolutely, and it works. It's true.
We should all do that. You know, that should be one of my recommendations.
Yeah, and by the way, I have learned a long time ago, and there's a rule I live my life by. A good teacher knows when to be a student, and a good leader knows when to follow. And I change hats 5-6 times a week. And I really believe that's the magic of being able to accept the knowledge and then apply that knowledge.
And discern what is good and what's going to work for you, right?
Yes. No, absolutely.
I think that if I were to summarize everything that you've said, it's sort of like this recipe, right? We need 20% of this and 10% of that. And if you throw in the vision and the positive expectation of the future And you throw in the process by which you get there, which is your plan, that is flexible. You adjust it, right? But it's flexible. Sure. It's there. And your action in making good choices and getting the right information for yourself. And what fuels all of that is motivation.
Yeah.
Right? How do you get to motivate yourself to actually go through with this process? And that's really interesting. This is what I've been studying and writing about in my book as well. How do you get the motivation? It comes from your values. When you realize what's important to you, then you can really tap into it so effectively.
You've got two motivating factors and two only. One is fear of loss. The other one is the desire for gain, which creates the value. That's the only thing that will cause anybody to move. If they know they'll gain by it, or they're afraid they're going to lose if they don't do it. Those are the motivators. And when it really comes down to it, and those are okay motivators. There's nothing wrong with either one of them. But realistically, that's that little aha moment, that impetus that causes you to move forward to realize that something's good, it isn't good, or whatever the case may be. But the motivation in and of itself, it can't really come from outside. The knowledge can be there, but the motivation has to come from inside, and there's got to be that perceived value for you inside of it. What am I going to get if I do it? And that's where the key is. And you know what you get? You get your life.
You get a wonderful life, right?
Yeah.
You get a wonderful life. And you know, there's so much research into that, into motivation as well. Ryan and Desi of Rochester University have come up with this self-determination theory. And it's so interesting because they show you a continuum, right? So they show you from 0 to 100 and, you know, 5 different things in between. And they break it down for you so you can actually see that, you know, I wouldn't do this for myself, but I would do it for my children. A lot of people that I work with say, yeah, all this financial stuff, you know, it's so boring, but I have 3 daughters and I have to do it for them.
You know, so, when it comes down to it, Julia, that's not true. Because in the end result, you're doing it for you. You're doing it for the emotional satisfaction. You did everything you could do to get them to have a decent life or enjoy themselves, whatever the case may be. Well, that's really the motivation behind all of it. That doesn't mean you're selfish or you don't love them and wouldn't go out and kill for them, quote unquote. But what it does mean is when we begin to realize that the only thing that we do, the only person we do anything for is ourselves and how we feel about it, after we've done it. And that does not make us selfish or anything else, because people benefit from that.
And, you know, you do it for your family. A lot of people actually build financially prosperous, secure lives because they want to provide it for their wives, husbands, children, grandparents, you know, etc. So I think it varies from a person to person. However, in the end, we all want to take care of ourselves. I understand what you're saying, right? We have people.
It's not being selfish.
Life.
You know, if you think about this, you want to do it for your kids, okay? Let me give you a hypothetical here. We got a couple minutes to go. Let me give you a hypothetical here. You raise your kids. You do everything you can possibly do to get them to put their foot on the path of having a decent life. The question normally would be, did you do it for you or did you do it for them? Most people said, well, I do it for them. It's not so, because if you look at it this way, they're 10 years old. You open the door. You say, get out. Go live life yourself. This is not home anymore. And do whatever you do to live. Now, as the person that you are today, you would feel horrible that you could ever do anything like that. So when it comes down to it, everything that you did for them was for the emotional satisfaction of knowing that you did everything you could possibly do. There's nothing wrong with that. Once you get that, it's great because everybody benefits from it. And that doesn't mean you don't love them totally in 3,000%, but it's for the emotional satisfaction. That's the impetus behind most actions.
Well, you know, one of the things that people always speak about in retirement is, I have fulfilled all of my obligations, and now I have the time to devote a lot more attention to what I've always wanted to do, to learn an instrument or to go and take a class at university or pursue a new hobby or a whole new career or even start a company. There are entrepreneurs in their 50s, 60s, 70s now, which is a remarkable trend.
Yeah, got you loud and clear. Okay, we're starting to run out of time. website, Julia, we can find you at, buy the book, and get more information and find out what you're doing and how you're doing it?
You can come to www.joycompass.com. So joycompass.com. And my book is on Amazon as well. And I welcome you to check out all the free ebooks and blogs and resources that are on my website. And definitely pay attention to your regional local events as well.
Wonderful. www.joycompass.com.
Gotcha.
Hey, Julia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you, and I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own, hallelujah. I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah. Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to, what are we listening to?
Dresser After Dark.
And thought-provoking talk. Something. Yeah. Oh, that's where I am. Okay.
But that was once upon a time.
Carla Moncari with us, the author of Echo, You, A Power of One. Improve your health, improve your life. She's an author, she's a life guide, she's a teacher and a retreat leader who assists individuals from all walks of life to improve their self-confidence, their self-esteem, their ability to meet life challenges. She's been doing this for more than 30 years now. She's guided individuals in understanding life's spiritual principles, spiritual activities, and rising emotions in their professional and private lives. Her success, I can say that word, with the Minute Method is unsurpassed. She is the founder of the Minute Method Teaching and co-founder of the Contemplative Innovative Teaching. Carla, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. I thought you were going to give away my sex life there for a moment.
Oh, I know. I don't ask me to say success 10 times because we're going to get the wrong words.
We can't give those secrets away.
That's one way to start a show. Hey, Carla, thank you so much for being here. By the way, when we talk about spirituality, how do we define that in a person's average life, everyday life?
Well, it's the way they respond to their different situations in their own life, personal and impersonal, their reactions. It should be practical. A spiritual life should be practical. It should work for you out here. It should reduce stress, not create it. It should give you more confidence, not less. That's a balanced spiritual life. Not just sitting with your legs crossed and your eyes closed. If that's all you do and you leave your pillow and it doesn't carry on out here in your practical life, I'd say find another method.
Now, by the way, I totally agree because I really believe today that when most people hear spirituality, they think, you've got to be sitting a foot off the ground, you're meditating and doing all kinds of things. That's not what it is. It's when you play, when you work, when you relate to people, when you have friends, when you're sitting down and you're crying about something, it's all constant. There is this consistency that's called your spirituality, and that's beyond those human problems that you create and think you can't solve.
Yes, it should be a seamless life. When you get up from whatever your practice is, it should be into your practical life. It should be seamless. A continuous connection.
Okay, the consciousness, which is a word that most people get confused about. Let's define what consciousness is.
Okay, consciousness. Well, there are different levels. You got your body consciousness, mind consciousness, and then what the word spiritual, beyond that. But the practical consciousness, that the awakening, the being aware, consciousness should be an aware. You should be an aware, conscious being. Most of us are conscious, but not very aware. And it's in the awareness that we have the conscious changes. And that's what the minute method will do. That's what brings about the changes. That making that 1 minute, twice a day, contact with that spiritual heart center, your other heart, that's right there. But you don't need 30 minutes. You don't need an hour. You only need that 1 minute twice a day. And then whatever it is that your needs are out here, if it's anxiety, if it's fear, it will definitely change because you are changing your consciousness.
There was a time that people were talking about, meditating, be in touch with yourself, being aware, and so on and so forth. But see, I think you've hit it spot on. Because if you can just do it for a minute, I remember the first time that I did it. I can't meditate. My mind is going in every direction five times faster than the speed of light. But then what I started to do was when I get into the shower, and I would intentionally take a shower before I went to sleep, and I let the water run on my head, and just for that moment, I just allowed myself to be right there. I didn't have a body. I didn't have a mind. There was no difference between the outside and the inside. And the first time it lasted for 5 seconds. I've got it up to about, almost a minute now. But the point is, in that moment of time, everything disappears and there's nothing there.
That's the present. You tapped into the very present. And when that occurs, there is no space and time. And that's the power we have. That's a power of one. And that power touches everything in our life out here. That will meet our needs out here. Let me tell you about these college students I had. I was doing a retreat, and they come exhausted, all stressed out, because they were going to be facing their finals in a couple of weeks. Well, they came to the retreat because the college was paying all their expenses. I didn't want to do any meditation, right? So this was about 6 years ago. And here I'm teaching them they have to sit for 30 minutes. At least four times, right, for about 4 days. Well, that lasted one day. Most of them weren't showing up. So that next morning, I said, what's going on here? And they gave me all kinds of excuses, how exhausted they are, how stressed they needed to sleep. So I made a pact with them because I had to send reports to their professor, and it was going to reflect on their grades, and they had to participate. So I made a pact with them. I said, okay, give me 1 minute twice a day, just 1 minute twice a day. Can we agree to that? And they were shocked. They said, oh, yeah, we can do that. And so they did it for the next 3 days. And I tell you the truth, Michael, I had different students there on that last day. Their attitude had changed. They were smiling. And I said, well, what happened? They said, well, we feel less stressful. We're sleeping better. We're feeling more confident about facing our finals. And that was only in 3 days. And there you go. The minute method was born. I said, hey, this is it. This can do it in a minute. That awareness is so powerful. just as you were doing in the shower. You get a few seconds. You get a minute of it. And it's amazing what it will do for you out here.
Let's go to the word awareness that you had said early on. You know,
yes.
Mind,
yes.
That, there's something I learned a long time ago. With most people, we go through life, and you're not even aware. When I say not even aware, everything around you doesn't mean anything. And just as an example, are you sitting by a desk?
Myself right now?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, are you sitting on a chair?
No, but I am sitting.
Okay, okay.
I'm sitting upright.
Okay, are you on the floor?
No, I'm on my craftmatic bed.
Oh, okay, you're on the bed. Okay, no, which is a good place to be. All right. That's in case the show gets too much, you pass out, you can go to sleep for a while.
Right, right. But okay, I'm upright. I have the bed up.
Okay, no, okay, the bed is up. Now, here, this is the key. Touch the bed. Just put your hand on the, touch the bed, okay?
I'm touching.
Okay. The bed just became in existence. Before you touch that bed, it didn't even exist. And most people are not even aware of their surroundings. But when you touch it, you put your attention on it, all of a sudden it came into existence. Most people run around and they don't live. Nothing exists because they don't have any awareness of it, because they're not mindful with it. And the moment that you do that, every once in a while when I feel myself drifting off, I just touch my chest. The moment I do that, I brought myself back into being. I'm here now. And I think that's so critically important. And that minute is so very important. And just to add to that, just a little, okay, it exists. It's here. When you're with somebody, touch them. They become there. I don't mean to do it to a stranger in public. You go to jail. But the point of contention is we don't pay attention to it, and most of us run through life 95% unaware.
Well, there you go. You're touching on it entirely. The minute method is a method of awareness. That's exactly what it's based on. That's the entire method, and that's what it will do for individuals. It will bring them into awareness, the awareness within, but it will become seamless. It will become practical out here. You become a more alert, a more aware being. And when that happens, you respond to everything differently. You have less stress. You have more confidence. Your self-esteem goes up. Awareness is absolutely amazing. It's like putting it into a bottle. I think we've bottled it. That's how I feel about it. That's how exciting this particular method is, because it's like none other. No mantra, no word, no sitting for 30 minutes. Hey, people are too busy today. We can't get them to sit that long. We lose them. But a minute, twice a day? Come on. Now, anyone can do this, and the benefits are unbelievable. I've had friends that have had migraines. When I finally convinced them to please do this, you know what? They've never had another migraine. Now, I'm not saying it's a cure-all, but it's close. It's close. Because provide your needs. Awareness will do that, because you are tapping into a power. This spiritual heart center is a powerhouse. And most people just don't know how to access it. And now this method will do it, and it will do it quickly.
And I really believe when it comes down to it, the reason it doesn't work for so many people is because we look outside for the answers to what we're looking for. And it isn't outside. The answers are from within. Now, you have to reach outside and get triggered to realize where to come back to get it at. But the answers come from within. You've created everything that you've ever gone through or done or been in your life. If you don't think that you're worth it, then you're going to go find misery just to prove yourself right about yourself. That's how powerful that is. And I've always believed this way. Everything is behavior. You learn. A behavior is something learned. If you can learn something, you can unlearn and you can relearn. You just have to have the want to do it.
Well, you have to start from within. This is true. You have to start with yourself. If you're going to change behavior, you must change consciousness. It has to come from within.
Yeah.
It doesn't last out here. Everything deteriorates out here. You can get motivated and excited, but it doesn't last. But if you get it from within, that doesn't fade. That's your reality. That's your realization. That's who you are. That's your nature. And that's what you're tapping in to. And that's what's going to change out here for your health, for your life, and you know what? For the environment. Because what awareness causes you to become aware, more aware, of your self-worth. And when you do that, you become aware of the environment's worth. You see, that's why it's connected. I connected this particular book to the environment, because there's no separation. There's only reflection. And we're going to reflect whatever our state of consciousness is.
And by the way, there's something that I got years ago, and I've got it here, and it makes so much sense. It's called, others are merely mirrors of you. You can't love, you can't hate. So you can't love or hate something about another person unless it reflects to you something you love or you hate about yourself. For years, I have said to people that the moment, if you're going to be a guest on the radio or even TV, if you're a guest in the media, there's 15-20% of the audience out there that is not going to like you. And it has nothing to do with you. It could be your ethnicity, your gender, the sound of your voice, your subject matter, something. And it has nothing to do with you. Years ago, I was in a workshop, and I stood up on the chair, and I looked at the audience, and I said, describe me. And I get everything from you loving, wonderful, nurturing individual to you self-centered, egotistical son of a yada, 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 right? And I said, who are you talking about? They said, you. I said, whoa, 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 whoa. See, it had nothing to do with me. It was a projection. And when we begin to get that, that if there's something you like or dislike, it's nothing more, and you just said it, it's a mirror. That's all it is, what you see.
It's reflecting.
We
see ourselves. Michael, we see ourselves coming and going. And that's the thing. And sometimes we don't like what we see, but we don't understand where it's coming from. It is coming from us, because that's what we attract. And that's what we will move away from. But it's from ourselves, and you really can't get away from yourself.
No.
That's the big mistake. And so when you tap into this awareness, only 1 minute, twice a day, then you begin to know who you are. When you do that, when you become aware of your reality, your worth, and Lord knows you are a beloved, then you value every and everything out here.
Yeah, we're starting to run out of time now, but before we do, there's one comment I want to make. Always be careful of the talk show host that can't say the word success. You never know what's going to come out of his mouth.
I sure will be. But hey, that's okay. Another topic. That's a great topic.
Okay, we're just about out of time. A website we can find you at?
My website is being built, unfortunately. It will be theminutemethod.com, but it's in now the process of being built. However, I do have an email that anyone can contact me with questions or more information if they please, and that's carla33@tampabay.rr.com.
Okay, and by the way, when you get your website, let us know, and we'll put it up on we'll put it up on our website, because we always have the list of guests that we've had on the show, and we'll just put your website up there when you get it.
Appreciate it, Michael.
Oh, my pleasure. Okay, by the way, good night, and thank you so much. I've appreciated your time.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Take care. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
The door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter.
too long.